This is my journey, inspired one story at a time. A library of leaders was created. It began as a journey to learn. As time went on, it began to grow. All it needed was a platform, and this podcast was created to listen, to inspire, to share. I am a storyteller, and this is my journey. Welcome to another episode of Profiles in Leadership. I am your host, Steve Anderson, and today's guest is Kelly Reed. Kelly is a past director, shareholder, and chairperson of the Board of Directors of Therapeutic Associates, a 100-plus clinical site for a physical therapy company in the Pacific Northwest. She was an All-American softball player at Pacific University. She received her physical therapy degree from Pacific University and has advanced credentials as a certification in orthopedic manual therapy. She is an orthopedic clinical specialist, and she has degrees and specialty programs in temporomandibular disorder, orthotics, and breathworks. She is a very dear friend, and she's really one of my favorite people on the planet. To me, Kelly is just the epitome of hard work and success that so many aspire to. I can't wait for you to hear her story and just feel her passion. So let's just hear what joy for life sounds like, and let's dive right in. Kelly, welcome to the program. I'm really excited to have you on the program, as not everyone knows, but we have been friends for an awful long time. So welcome.
Thanks, Steve. It's an honor to be on your show.
And how many years? Well, probably it's going to expose how old we are, but how many years have we been friends?
Oh, I think we just discussed this, and I think it was around 1991.
Okay. That's a ways ago. So let's just jump right in. Now, tell us a little bit about your story. Now, you actually grew up on a farm.
Yeah. So I'm a native Oregonian. I grew up on a strawberry and onion farm down in an area that's called Lake Labiche, down outside of Salem, Oregon. And we were up when the sun was up, and we worked as long as Dad said we had to work.
And what do you remember about that? I mean, what lessons did you learn? Obviously, you probably learned some work ethic, but what are the things about that upbringing think set you up for success?
You know, my dad was a hard worker, but he was also a lot of fun. So, I mean, we worked hard, but we played hard too. And I think I learned early that, you know, you just work and get it done. And then when it's time to play, you can play hard and have a good time.
And when you look back on that, was that, did the family, you know, struggle a little bit financially, or were you comfortable? What's the farm like back in those days?
Yeah, it really depends. I mean, as a kid, you could tell when it had been a good year, because we would do more fun things away from home. So we might take a trip. A big vacation for us was to take a trip to the beach and spend a night in a hotel. And we'd have food on the beach and we'd play games. And then we'd come home the next day. Versus, I remember years when my mom and dad were arguing because there was no, you know, not appropriate food for dinner that night. So it's a gamut when you're really looking at the harvest and the season, and some years are tough.
So you grow up on a farm, you obviously finish high school, and then you go off to college, and you love sports. You participate in a lot of sports in high school, I believe.
Yeah, I played in high school and college.
And so when you were in college, you're a softball player and an All-American softball player. So tell us a little bit about what position did you play and what was that experience like?
Well, I want to back up a little bit, because I actually started playing softball, competitive softball, well before high school. And actually, my first year of high school was the first year that there was softball in the high school system. And at this point, we had moved, and now I was up in Beaverton. So playing softball and competitive softball was a huge role in my life, because it was the first time I ever traveled on an airplane. Had it not been for sports, I would never have had that opportunity. So it started pretty young. And then it just fed my, I was competitive from the time I was little. I was from a family of four kids, and there was only one boy. So I was my dad's second son.
That's great. And what position did you play in softball?
Yeah, so I played second base and shortstop.
Okay. And what was your hitting style? Were you a singles hitter, or were you the big hitter?
Well, if it tells you anything, I was leadoff. Okay. And I could switch hit.
Oh, so great.
Regardless of whether it was a single or a double or a home run, I got on base.
Yeah, that's awesome. And you must have had some wheels, too, to steal.
Yep.
That's so cool. Now, so then you go on to PT school at Pacific University, I believe, and then took your first job out of school. What were you looking for, and what were you excited about the profession?
Well, it was really interesting because back then, you know, you were told you needed to work in a hospital for a year, and excuse my language, but there was no way in hell I wanted to do that. I knew I wanted to be an orthopedic sports PT, and I was really excited about the opportunity to work in that environment. But when I graduated, there were very few job openings. And one of my colleagues, or one of my buddies in PT school, had just done an affiliation in a clinic down in Eugene, and they offered her a job, and she didn't want to be in orthopedics, but told them that they should interview me. So I went down, and luckily I got the job. So I had to move away from home down to Eugene, and I was down there for a year and a half. The guy I was dating was up in Portland, and so I gave a six-month notice to come back to the Portland area, and I had earmarked three different clinics that were my top pick, only to find out that all three of those clinics were what would later be known as therapeutic associates clinics.
That's great. And, you know, because I do know you well, I mean, you are an amazing PT. You have your OCS, your COMT, you have a TMD, a specialization. I mean, you've really worked hard and studied hard to be a great PT.
Yeah, I love PT. I love to learn. And, you know, it's really special when you can help people feel better, and they appreciate it for years and years.
And looking back on that, what was the desire? I mean, that's a lot of continuing education. That's a lot of study beyond the basics, for sure. What motivated you, and what kept you going to that level?
I've always been the kind of person that wanted to be the best I could be. And for the COMT, I figured if I was good enough to be able to specifically manipulate any joint, I knew I would be good enough to diagnose everything around that joint. And I always felt if you were really good at what you did and you created relationships with people, everything else would follow.
Yeah, it's a great philosophy. Now you're a PT, you're using your skill, you've become very accomplished, but you have a opportunity to become a clinic director, which includes managing people. So what was that, what did that look like on the front end, and was it what you thought it would be?
Yeah, you know, I like the opportunity to keep growing and keep challenging myself. And where that came from, honestly, I don't know. But so when I was working in a clinic and saw that there was an opportunity for growth to be a manager of my own clinic, I wanted that opportunity. I wanted to see what that was like. And I'm sure that there was a little bit of ego involved in that. I felt like I could perhaps be a better director or manager than maybe what I had experienced at times. And I wanted that opportunity to lead a team. I always looked at the work environment as kind of either a family or a team environment. And trying to foster that kind of attitude was something I looked forward to.
And those with inside Therapeutic Associates know this, but maybe those that are outside of it may not. But I mean, you literally had one of the most successful and profitable clinics in the entire company for decades. So what's the secret formula or what's the secret sauce just to keep that going as successful as it was all those years?
Well, it's kind of an interesting story because when I did have the opportunity to become a director, it wasn't the usual path. I had kind of been earmarked to take over for the clinic I was in when he retired, but one of the other shareholders opted to retire first. And when I took over that clinic, it was a great clinic, but a smaller volume, around 350 visits a month. And over time, over the next couple of years, I really marketed, used my name recognition in the clinic and in the environment to really increase the volume of that clinic. And we ended up over time being up over 1,000 visits every month. And honestly, I think it was the dedication of my team and what I inspired in them to be the best clinic we could be and to have the best reputation in our community. That coupled with treating your patients really well, not just clinical skills, but, you know, going above beyond to create a 10-star visit so that they would refer their brother and their mother and everyone they knew. That's how we built it.
So how would you describe your leadership style? If I were to ask your staff, what style does Kelly lead under, what would you say?
Well, I'm not going to use all the appropriate terms, but I think the first is that I just am real. I'm just being me all the time. That's from the crazy side, having fun, to the serious side. I never ask anyone to do something they haven't seen me do. And I think I'm a very empowering leader, trying to bring out the best that each person brings. And I'm a really good listener.
And how did that go? I mean, did it evolve? I mean, did you just have a lot of those natural tendencies from the get-go, or did you grow over time? Explain how that came to be.
Yeah, no, it totally grew over time. It's a little scary to think back at those early staff meetings that I may have run. I think I kind of started off a little like a bull in a china shop, kind of just get her done and everybody should be following along. And I learned over time, and I'm sure was influenced by my love for the outdoors and yoga at the same time, because it allowed me to be more present. And the more present I became over time, coupled with my knowledge, my desire to learn, reading, you know, leadership books, et cetera, I started to put together what I felt was a recipe that would help create an environment that people would prosper in.
So expand on that a little bit more. How does nature and being outdoors help you become a better leader?
Well, I think that when you're outdoors, you connect more with the whole environment as well as with yourself. And I should preface this by saying I'm also have Native American heritage. So if anytime I can be barefoot and in the dirt, I'm quite happy. But I think that time to just be quiet and listen, things bubble up. And when you can then kind of work through those, whether it's work problems or whatever problems, there's an amount of clarity that comes before you that then allows you to problem solve in a different way than perhaps you would have before.
So you said you had Native American roots. Can you share that with us? How far back do you know, and what do you know?
Yeah, so my great grandmother on my mom's side was full-blood Cherokee. And I don't know a lot more beyond that. They were from Oklahoma, and the county courthouse that had all the records burnt to the ground. And no one in my family at that time pursued trying to get those reproduced. So that's kind of the end of my story.
Yeah, that's amazing. So now, you know, you're chugging along, you're a clinic director, you're leading a team, you have a very successful clinic, everything seems to be firing on all cylinders, but there was something missing. You had some real challenges with infertility and tougher to have a family than you thought it would be. So could you just share with us what that was like and the struggles that you had?
Yeah. So a little background. When I was 13, I wanted to adopt 5 kids so I could have my own basketball team.
There you go.
But then I did wise up over time. So then I wanted to have 3 kids, was kind of in my plan. And I wanted to have those 3 kids getting started by at least by the time I was 30. And so we have this vision for what our life is going to look like. And I met my Mr. Wright, and he was a little hesitant to get started with a family right away. And I said, okay, well, you better get me a dog then. So we had our first 4-legged child named Barkley. And then a few years later, we said, okay, you know, we're ready. And only to find out that we were having trouble getting pregnant. And it was really hard. I knew I was, one of the reasons I was put on this earth was to be a mom. And I knew, I had a deep feeling that I wasn't sure how the baby was going to get in my arms, but there would be one. And we talked about adopting, but we decided to try different angles first, and we were blessed. And so we had Sam, and then we decided, well, you know, let's have another one pretty close. One, because I was getting older and we thought maybe that was part of the problem, but also that we were kind of wanting to have our, what we decided now was going to be 2 kids, and then be able to have them be close and then we could move on with our family. And went through the same process that we did to get Sam, and we had a little surprise because we had twins. And so we had 3 kids under 2. At the same time that I was directing the clinic and running the busiest patient load. And yeah, it was a lot, but I got my 3 kids.
Oh, that's what a great story. But yeah, that's when you thought you were busy as you could possibly be, all of a sudden you became busier. So I guess we can reach different levels there.
Yeah, that's for sure.
What life lesson did you learn during that struggle and that process and the disappointment yet and then the extreme joy? I mean, can you look back on that and just say, did I look at life differently now than I did before?
Yeah, you know, I think the first thing is where I got this deep feeling of knowing that I would be a mom. And it was just so strong, like there, no one was going to tell me it wasn't going to happen. And so I think from that, I learned to really listen and trust my intuition. And I carried that forward in business decisions. You know, when there appeared to be really 2 really good choices, I would always go back to my gut. And it served me very well. And I think also that what I learned during that time is that, one, we can love more than we ever thought we could. And 2, that no matter how tough things can be at times, you can get through it. But it really helps when you call in support from, you know, people around you. And I think from that, I learned, don't be afraid to ask for help.
Yeah, those are great lessons. So now you're your clinic director, and then you have a chance to become a shareholder in the company, an ownership position. And so you take that, and I think it's pretty impressive in the sense that, I don't know if you ever really thought of it up front, but you know, you really paved the way for a lot of female shareholders and therapeutic associates. Not that anyone was trying to keep women out of those positions, but you were one of the pioneers. Pat Snyder was the first woman shareholder, and And then you were the second. But I just checked today to be accurate, and now there are 17 women and their shareholders in Therapeutic Associates, and there's been quite a few that have retired and are not in that count as well. So do you feel like a pioneer? Do you feel like you paved a way for people behind you?
Well, I'm not old enough to be a pioneer, Steve. But I do feel like I paved the way, more so when I got on the board of directors. I think that really showed, because I was the first woman on the board. And I think that showed other women that whatever your goal is, whatever level within the company, it's possible. And I also think that when I, so back in my own clinic, three little kids, I was struggling. I created a new pathway for other females in the company because I created a clinic within my clinic to allow my partner, Amy Jackson, to be able to become a shareholder in the company. And I knew that I couldn't do it alone any longer with the size of our clinic and be able to stay balanced and present for my family as well as present in the clinic at the level that I wanted to be. And I think that is one of the things that I'm most proud of.
And it should be noted as well that you had to give up some financial position to do that as well. It wasn't just something that you did out of the goodness of your heart. Again, it was a good move for you for lifestyle, but it also had some financial implications too.
Yeah. And, you know, it's interesting, Steve. Yeah, I get the business side. I get all the financials, but I have to say that I was never motivated by money. That's not what I did, my job. I did what I did because I loved and have passion for our profession. And I have passion for people and relationships. And so anything I had, I was the kind of person who hired someone who wanted my job so that I could help them get to where they wanted to be. And so it was important to me for Amy to have that same opportunity that I had, because I knew that she only wanted to work 3 days a week. She also had three kids, and I figured together we could create a win-win.
Yeah, that's awesome. And I know you, and you already mentioned it earlier in this interview, that you just love treating patients, and you're still treating patients. So how do you do it physically? I mean, being a physical therapist on your feet all day long is not an easy job. And I'm just curious as to how you can do it physically.
Yeah, well, I do think I've been blessed in that in my whole career, I've really not had any PT-related injuries. But one of the things that did move me towards retiring from being a director was I was starting to feel it physically and mostly in my thumbs, because I'm not a very big gal, and yet, you know, I can treat big people and I can manipulate. So that was one of the things that started to tell me it was time to change. I never saw myself fully leaving, but I'll tell you, it's a lot easier to work 2 days a week than it is to work five.
Yeah. So, you know, so here you are, you're on the board of directors, you're running a very successful and profitable clinic. You have three young children. And you're still doing it all. And I when I was the CEO of the company, I said, holy cow, we need Kelly to teach the rest of us how to do this. So I convinced you to teach a class in our leadership development program called Setting a Pace with Grace, which was your choice for a title. So tell us a little bit about that, and what was the message you were trying to get through in that class?
Well, I'm still mad at you for roping me into that, but in hindsight, it was probably one of the best things that happened to me, because it made me really dive into, you know, what is balancing your lifestyle? And what I realized is, you know, there is no balance. We weren't intended to have this perfect balance in our life. Life is this road that goes up and down and around and sideways. But what's important is that you realize what your values are, what are your big core principles that you want to live your life by, And then you navigate those, everything else around those things. And so when I did the research to be able to teach this class, I learned a lot in the process and kind of deepened what I intuitively had been able to accomplish. And it was important to me, knowing how hard a director in therapeutic associate works, to be able to teach at least some principles, some guiding light of how you might be able to make your best choices.
And do you remember actually making a difference in somebody's life or outlook on life when they took that course, and maybe some light bulbs went off and some learning took place? Do you remember some of those moments?
You know, I totally do. Reading some of the reviews, because, you know, all of our leadership classes, we get evaluated. Reading some of the reviews, but more importantly, having people email me a year and a half or so after they had taken the class to say, hey, just wanted you to know, I called on my Pace of Grace stuff, and this is what happened, and I really want to thank you for that.
Yeah, that's great.
I know without a doubt it did have some impact.
Yeah, and I can reinforce that as well. It was one of the favorite classes that in the program, and people signed up in droves to take it. And so, again, I'm sorry I twisted your arm so hard, but it was well worth it. It was something that people really got a lot out of. So now you're on the board, and later in your career being on the board, because you were there for quite a while, you were elected by your peers to become a chairperson of the board. So how did that change your position on the board and your outlook, and what did you feel in that position different than before?
Yeah, the chairperson role was something that we separated the CEO from the chairperson of the board right after your tenure. And so it was a new role. Nobody in our company had done it before. So I had to do some research about what it meant in a normal company and then what it meant in a privately held company like Therapeutic Associates. And, you know, I enjoyed trying to figure that out and trying to figure how I would fit. And it was important to me that I was able to support our new CEO, but to stay distant enough to make sure that I was keeping him accountable to the board of directors. And that was not a role I took lightly. And I think I managed it fairly well.
Yeah, I'm sure you did. And I can remember when you were on the board that you were always the champion for the people, champion for shareholders. I can remember that you were never one to take a vote and majority wins. It was always, well, if there's enough people that are uncomfortable with this decision, we need to find a better solution. And you always fought for that. So that was your philosophy.
Yeah. I think also in that role, it was a little more empowering to really push for the things that I felt we as a company were lacking, and that, like in the area of just more direct communication and connecting with our shareholders, but also with our key people coming up that were, you know, trying and working hard to become a shareholder themselves. And so I do think culturally we benefited from some of the steps we took to increase that engagement.
What do you think it is that company, Therapeutic Associates, they are celebrating their 70th year this year? It was started in 1952 by a guy by the name of James B. McKillop. What do you think it is about that company that just it just keeps going strong and just keeps growing and just keeps attracting great people? What is it?
I think it's a couple of things. One, I think James McKillop had a great business model to start with because it was based on sharing the wealth and helping people move into business that had that desire to run a private practice on their own, but needed mentorship. And then I think the second thing is really good karma, where people who are passionate and love what they do and put that back into the environment, they attract the same. So they attract more people that want the same thing. And I mean, we've been blessed with really cool people in Therapeutic Associates. And I know that happens in a lot of other companies too, but sometimes I'm amazed when I meet new people in the company and I realize, wow, you're a keeper too. You know, all of them seem to be just have that same desire to be the best they can be in the clinic, but also best they can be in a leadership mentorship role.
You know, we just finished a project for Therapeutic Associates. They kind of did a history project and did a lot of interviews of retired shareholders. And one of the things that I guess I always knew, but just came out very glaringly in all the stories, was how many people were kind of like you and me, which got into that company very early in our careers and never left. You know, it's unbelievable how many 30, 35, even 40, and even more than that years in the same company that people stayed. So I guess I look at that and say there must have been something good because people stayed, and that really bucks most of the other systems in the sense of how people change jobs these days.
I think the other aspect of it too, Steve, was that we all liked each other and we played well together. So, you know, as shareholders, we would go on a retreat, and the best part of it was to meet spouses and, you know, play volleyball together or whatever, golf, whatever we were doing. But we all really liked each other outside of the clinical work as well. And so I think Therapeutic Associates has done a great job of fostering that ability to play in addition to work.
Yeah, I would agree. So, you know, we already identified all the different specialties that you have and that you worked so hard to become very proficient at. And now there's another one that you discovered a little later in your career. And within TAI, it was called Breathworks. And now you're working with a company called Breathe Your Truth. So explain to us a little bit about what that company or what that approach is about and why you're so passionate about it.
Yeah, well, it really started back in 2006, actually. David Deppler, and David's the founder of Breathe Your Truth. He and I went to take a continuing ed course because by that time we'd pretty much taken everything else that was good. And it was a course on the thoracic spine, but mostly focusing on breathing and breathing dysfunction. We thought, oh, well, let's try this. And so we took the course, and it was a little eye-opening, but mostly fell short of what, you know, we walked out saying, there's really something here, but we have to do a lot more study. And we got introduced to a capno trainer. And so then we started kind of messing around with it, but neither of us had the confidence to take it even into the clinic. So we were just messing around on ourselves, trying to understand, you know, O2, CO2, what the readings meant, et cetera. And so we were both at that time running clinics ourselves. And so there wasn't a lot of time to progress the program, but we kept dabbling in it, kept taking other courses. And over time, together, we developed the Breathworks program in Therapeutic Associates. And we kept Now we had taken it into the clinic and we started to mentor other people in the company. And then David decided to move on and do his own thing. And then in that free time he had after he had left Therapeutic Associates, he really birthed a fabulous project in Breathe Your Truth. And so now we teach nationally and are credentialing coaches, breathing coaches, to help further the knowledge about breathing and how important it is in everyone's life. And we think it's just a fabulous fit in the physical therapy environment. So it's really cool stuff.
So I am the first to admit that I was slow to grasp the concept. You know, I know that you guys were working on that when I was part of the company, and I just, you know, it sounded cool, but I just didn't really get it. And then I read a book called Breathe by James Nestor. And I remember it was just so fascinating and just really, really good information. And I called you and said, is this legit? And you said, yes, it is. So just explain to the listeners here what the concept is about how we breathe and why it's important to breathe correctly and what are we trying to do by breathing in the correct way.
Well, you know, I think part of the reason you didn't pick up on it earlier, or a lot of people don't, is because obviously you were breathing. And breathing is something we really take for granted. I mean, when you go in for your annual checkup at your physician's office, they never ask you about your breath. And so what we realize is the combination of O2 and CO2 is responsible for the pH of our blood. And there's a sweet spot for the pH of our blood to be. And if we are out of that on either high or low, then micro things start to happen to our systems, our organs, our muscles, our brain. And we're functioning in a deficit. And so breathing is one of those things that with proper efficiency and effectiveness of our breath, we can right the ship very quickly. So some key points are just breathing nasally. A lot of people are mouth breathers, and when they're mouth breathing, they tend to breathe fast. They tend to breathe a chest breather. And so all of a sudden, they're in their fight or flight response, really bolstering up their sympathetic response that was meant for emergencies, and now that's their way of life, their way of being. And those people are what we call hypocapnic. Their CO2 levels are too low. Generally, before, we used to believe that O2 was the driver of our breathing, and research has shown that it's actually CO2 that's the driver of our breathing, because CO2 is what tells hemoglobin to let go of the oxygen that we've been able to breathe in. And if we don't have enough CO2, hemoglobin binds, and so we don't get the benefit of all that oxygen. So we feel like we have to breathe more, when in fact, what we need to do is exhale more.
And it's just interesting what the book laid out pretty well for me, at least, was that as we have evolved as humans, we've kind of learned how to breathe inappropriately, which is more of the mouth breathing. So if we do convert to be more of a nose breather in and out, what does that do to our system that makes us healthier?
Yeah. So when we breathe through our nose, we produce nitric oxide. Nitric oxide is this cool little element that is antiviral, antibacterial, antioxidant. It purifies and it moisturizes the air, but it also helps boost our CO2 level. In addition to nasal breathing, it also helps form the structure of our face, our mouth, our teeth alignment. And Nestor does a great job in his book, Breathe, of kind of pulling all that information together. You know, it's a little embarrassing that a writer, a journalist is the one that created and pulled all this information together that he did in the book, but a job well done.
Yeah. It's a fascinating book. I would highly recommend it. It definitely caught my attention. And you can see that if, you know, you're working with athletes and trying to optimize their performance and people that just want to be healthier and look at wellness in a different way, how it would be interesting. But you see a lot of patients that come to you that are just, maybe they're in a chronic pain stage or they're just messed up and their breathing is just pathetic. Tell us a little bit about what you see.
Well, when you know what you're looking for, one of the things that we educate the people that we teach, the therapists that we teach, is to look for contributing factors that could take you back to the breathing. And so when you have someone that's not following the normal course of improvement that you would expect with your normal manual therapy interventions, really take a look at their breathing, because they'll show up in that pattern that I described earlier of chest breathing. So they've lost connection with their diaphragm, and our diaphragm is our most efficient power source of our breath cycle. So they're in their chest, their mouth breathing, because it's the path of least resistance, but not realizing that also that dries them out. So they're dehydrating. And then commonly the third part of that triad we see is that they're breathing fast. So that feeds into stress and anxiety, and it's just a mess that adds into their other musculoskeletal issues. But oftentimes the reason that they can't get over their issue, their musculoskeletal issues, is because physically they're not getting that oxygen to the muscles because of the way they're breathing.
Yeah, that's just fascinating. And do you see that is the medical community recognizing this now, or is it just still slow to come? I mean, it seems like it's one of those things that's easy to do and has, you know, really positive ramifications. So it seems like it would catch on and really take off. Is it doing that?
Well, it is. And a part of the reason it is because of Nestor's book, because it's become a real buzz. But in the medical profession, I think, unfortunately, COVID has helped us out a lot, because a lot of physicians are grasping for what else is there to offer my patients. And so I'm getting more referrals now than I have in the past. Also in Therapeutic Associates, we have a website that, you know, basically is just for breathworks, where people can be searching for breathing issues, find our website, and then they can take a questionnaire. And we're getting between, I would say, 2 and 8 referrals a month that we, you know, 3-4 years ago, we weren't getting that volume. So the uptick is really, I had 2 just this week.
Yeah. No, I think it's, the respiratory issues that COVID brought to the forefront are, you know, people are thinking about, and, you know, not being able to breathe or struggling to breathe has got to be the most frightening thing you can think of.
It's interesting too, Steve, because one of my main referrers is a pulmonologist, and I had an in to see one of his clients, and they did very well, and went back and told him about the work we had done together. And so he calls me up and says, you know, I have a few questions for you, because I've never seen anybody do anything like this. And because what we do is very different than pulmonary rehab. And he was very impressed, and has since been sending not just people that go to him to rule out pulmonary issues, but people with actual pulmonary dysfunction. Because what we found is that even if they do have a true dysfunction, the more they know how to breathe properly, it helps their levels.
Yeah. And I think what really stood out to me in the book as well is that, you know, we live in a society now where anxiety and stress just continues to get higher and higher, and more people struggle with it. Yet here's a treatment or a behavior that you can adopt, and it can significantly help those issues.
Yeah, I can't tell you the amount of times that people have said, "You saved my life," or "This was a game changer," and they want to know, why didn't anybody tell me about this before?
Yeah, that's great. Well, it's amazing work, and I think there's more and more to learn and discover, but congratulations for bringing it to the forefront. That's awesome.
Yeah, it is good work, and I'm glad to be surrounded and to be working with the team that I am, both in Breathworks and with Breathe Your Truth, because David's really got an amazing program going.
Yeah, that's great. So let's switch gears here a little bit. You said earlier that you had the love of outdoors, but describe your perfect day. What's it look like?
Oh, that could go lots of directions. My perfect day is I'm an early riser, so I usually wake up naturally when it's dark out, brew a great cup of coffee, sit and read my book, and watch the sunrise. Sunrises are one of my favorite things. Then go for a run. A trail run is my favorite. If it's raining and muddy, that's even better. Come back. If it's a day I'm not working, then my husband and I power walk together, and we go 3.5 miles with our dog out in the country to this quarry where the dog can be off leash. And then come back, and well, this sounds like all I do is exercise, but then the next best thing, if we didn't do our power walk, would have been that we would have taken off and either gone on a hike or gone skiing, and then stop at a brew pub on the way home and come home, make dinner, and build a fire in the fireplace and watch some sporting event.
Yeah, that sounds great. Sounds like a really good day. The only negative of that would be that you're probably watching a duck game, and that's not everybody's choice, right?
Oh yeah, I'd watch a duck game.
So you've been at this a long time. You've done a lot of amazing things in your career and your life. What's on your bucket list?
Well, I knocked off one of them this year. It was a default plan, but we hiked down the Grand Canyon and then rafted out for 10 days. And it was amazing. I'd say that.
So before you leave that, because I have insider information, tell us the story about how you took a hike and really pushed your physical limits to the edge, and tell us what that was, what that experience was like, and the fear you felt, and what you felt like when you accomplished it.
Okay. So on this rafting out, your guides will just pull over when they found a nice beach or a great camp, because there's a lot of different companies on the river. And this one night we had pulled over and had dinner, and we had done a small hike that day. And the guide had thrown out to the group that if we wanted, we could do a really nice long hike the next day from the same campsite that would go up a riverbed up to some ruins. And the group was really divided, because some of us really wanted to go and others didn't want to go at all. And so our guide was like, I actually caught him off on his raft by himself, just like pondering what decision he was going to make. Long story short, he decided that the next day, it was a beautiful day. It was a great camp. There was lots of shade. People could do their laundry if they didn't want to hike, but the people that wanted to hike deserved to be able to hike. So we take off. And I don't know, it was maybe 5 miles in, we get to the ruins.
Let me interrupt here, but they also painted a picture that this was going to be very rigorous and it wasn't for the light of heart. And I mean, they really painted the picture that this was an extreme challenge.
Well, they said that the 5 mile hike wasn't the extreme challenge. What they said was bring your headlamp though, because there might be an opportunity to add on. And for anybody who wanted to add on, you might come home in the dark. So we all took our headlamps, not knowing what we would decide. So when we got done at the ruins, this guide said, okay, if anybody wants to go on, here's what we could do. And he hiked us around this rim and he pointed up to this big rock formation, and it was called Doc's Castle. And he said, if anybody wants to go on, we'd go up, climb up to that, then we go around the backside, come down the other side, and then we'll have to find a path down back to the Slot Canyon to get back to where camp is. And I had already mentioned that I probably wasn't going to do it, because I knew if I said yes, my husband would say yes, and I knew that his knees would not tolerate that climbing. So I had already made up my mind that I wasn't going to go. And so he said, told the group what we're going to do. And he said, okay, does anybody want to go? And my husband was the first one to say, hey, I'm out. I don't think my knees can handle it. And then my best friend said, you know, I'm out. I'm not coming home in the dark. So when they both bowed out, I knew I had permission to go, not technically permission, but in my mind, I had permission. And so then I shifted to, if just one more person goes, I'm going. Because the two guides that were going to go were young and fast, and I didn't want to hold them back. And then these two other guys said they were going to go, and I had been out hiking one of them the whole time. And I said, okay, I'm in. And I will not forget the look on Greg's face. He looks at me and he says, what? And I said, yeah, I want to go. And he goes, okay. And he got quiet for a minute and he goes, okay, tell me why you want to go. And I said, I think it's a chance of a hike of a lifetime. And he said, are you sure? And I said, I'm sure. And so we took off. And I'll tell you, there were a couple times I thought, what the hell am I doing? It was really hands and feet climbing up rocks. There was no path. We were just exploring, but it was treacherous. And it wasn't so much the up climbing. And the other part was that we got to this point and I was starting to, you know, suck air a little bit, and I'm in pretty good shape, but I wasn't accounting for the elevation because we were up around 7,000 feet at that point. But I just stopped and waited and caught my breath, and I didn't have any altitude kind of thing. It was more just fatigue. But then we get through the high part and then we have to come back down. And the guides were great. And the main guide would take off and he'd say, okay, this is it. Nope. He'd come back. Nope. That's not it. Two or three times. And finally he comes back and he goes, okay, I found the spot for us to get down. The first two parts of it are going to be really tough. But once we get past that, we're golden. And the other guide looked at me. She was the only other female. And she said, Kelly, how are you feeling about that? And I can't quote to you right now on this casting of what I said inside myself, but it was not good. But I wasn't going to say that to them because that was not going to help anything. And what I said to them was, I know you guys have my back, and if you think I can do it, I'm in. And so what we did then was we went down basically a straight rock face that was probably 15, 20 feet onto a little ledge, and there were just barely little handholds. But the guide, you know, stayed right below, helped guide my feet, my hands, and there was one spot where my foot couldn't quite reach because I'm like 5'4" and a half, but he just grabbed my foot and said, we got to get it, and pulled my foot down, and we made it. And it was, I just didn't look down. I just knew I had to do what I had to do. And we got on semi-solid ground, and then it was going down the rest of the way. And I'll tell you, I've never been so happy to see a bona fide trail again.
Oh, that's a great story. Yeah. That's, fearful, afraid, but yet when you accomplish it and you're down, such a feeling of vigor and pride, I would think.
It truly was a hike for me of a lifetime. I can't really imagine that I'll do something like that to that extent again, but I'm glad I did it.
Great. Well, Kelly, at this time of the interview, I always ask a common question to my guests, and that question is, in relation to leadership, what is a pearl of wisdom that you can leave us with today?
To stay present and to listen.
Yeah, that's great advice. Well, Kelly, you know, if you were to ask me what my perfect day would be, it would probably include sitting down and talking with you, because it's always a pleasure. You're passion is infectious. Your energy is so positive, and it's just always fun to sit down and talk with you. So thanks for being my guest today and sharing with us some really impactful things, not only about your success in your career, but being vulnerable in your personal life as well. I really appreciate it.
Thanks, Steve. It was an honor to be here, and I'd sit down and chat with you anytime.
All right. Well, take care, and we'll see you down the road soon.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you for listening to another episode of Profiles in Leadership. To listen to all my interviews, subscribe to Profiles in Leadership with Steve Anderson on Apple Podcasts, iTunes, and many other popular podcast platforms. Some of these interviews are on video, and you can search YouTube for Profiles in Leadership with Steve Anderson.
You can also access the entire library of interviews on my website, orange.coaching.com, and that is orange.coaching.com, and go to the Media Center and click on Podcasts or Video Gallery. You can also enter the website from pilpodcast.com.